Hey, you're listening to the Coach Your Best podcast. I'm your host, Jeremy Boone. You can find me on the web at www.athletebydesign.com. Be sure and follow me on Twitter at the user handle athletebydesign. And we're starting a brand new podcast series that will be titled Play Your Best Basketball. And I'm just real excited throughout this series to have some conversation with Brian McCormick. Brian is the founder and owner of the website www.developyourbballiq.com. And I'd actually have come across Brian and some of his writings on his blog, which really piqued my interest, that were rooted out of one of his first books that he wrote called Developing Basketball Intelligence. And so just a great resource to go on there, check out his blog, and look at some of that material. And he's gone on to write other books and have other resources for basketball players, one of the most recent being his book, Crossover. Brian, how are you, buddy? Thanks for joining us.
I'm great. Thanks for having me, Jeremy.
Oh, yeah. Well, listen, it's something I'm definitely excited about, mostly just because all the material that I've gotten to read that you've published and through some of our conversations we've had here recently, you know, are not just around either the X's and O's of how to get stronger for a sport-specific strength program, for example, for basketball, but looking at how do we develop fundamentally sound, good decision makers on the court that involves also building, you know, a better athlete. So, you know, for those listeners out there, Brian, give us a little down and dirty background about you know, how you started the site. You know, I certainly know that, you know, you've got your CSCS, but kind of give us a little more detail in kind of your story.
All right. That website's probably the third or fourth version of different blogs that I started probably around 2002, 2003. That kind of it became an extension of my book. When I published the books, I kind of changed them around and everything. But primarily I started writing when I was finishing college and starting coaching. Started coaching when I was in college with younger kids, and then moved up and started coaching college as soon as I graduated. Been over and coached in Europe a couple of times, and then, you know, got my master's, got my CSCS, got onto the strength and conditioning side as well. So this year I've just been finishing up a PhD in exercise and sports science at the University of Utah. I coached freshman high school basketball and as a strength and conditioning coach for the men's and women's basketball teams at the local junior college, both of whom were rated in the top 20 for most of the year. So, you know, I have like 13 books now that I've written, plus the blogs and everything. So just trying to stay busy.
Yeah, I know. I like it. I like it. Well, I think to really get this whole series started off, you know, on the best note, let's talk a little bit about some of the concepts from your Developing Basketball Intelligence book, and at least use this as a gateway into some more specific topics built around performance, both from a decision-making standpoint and a physical performance, you know, for basketball players. But right out of the gate, let's talk about what are some of the qualities, you know, that you are describing when you use the term an intelligent player.
The easiest way to think about an intelligent player to me is it's somebody who makes the right play at the right time. So that doesn't always have to be, you know, most of the time it's simply making the easy play, you know, taking whatever the defense gives you. So if you're open, you're going to, you know, make the shot. If the pass is open, then you make the pass. But it's just making the right play. Part of it is also being in the right position at the right time. So, you know, somebody like Shane Battier, who at this point in his career is certainly not one of the fastest or quickest players in the league, but he's always in the right position. And so, you know, the ball always seems to find him when he's open. You know, he always tends to be there, you know, ready to take a charge, you know, two steps before the guy's even committed to the lane. So I think those are two of the main things. And then, you know, getting a little bit more beyond that, the players that, you know, you would kind of classify as the best in terms of intelligence are the ones that are creative in their decision making, and then they find the optimal solution. So, you know, in any given situation, there could be more than one option that could be deemed right. You know, so I could be I could be open, but my teammate could also be open, you know. So if I shoot the ball, you know, I could say that that's a right decision because I was open, you know, or I could pass the ball because my teammate was open. But the optimal decision, there's usually only one optimal decision, you know. So if my teammate is wide open under the basket, that's probably the best decision is for me to pass him the ball. But if he's, you know, running full speed at the basket and he has bad hands, you know, maybe me shooting the ball is a better option than trying to pass it, you know, through a defender's hands to somebody who's not great at catching the ball. So to me, those are kind of the basic things that I'm looking for is creativity in decision making, making the optimal play, but in simplistic terms, just kind of making the right play at the right time and being in the right place at the right time.
Yeah, and you know, I like the words you're using and kind of your descriptive definition there, but you know, don't you think or at least I know I find when I have a chance to go and watch, and more so young programs, Brian, in basketball, or really any sport, soccer, I mean, you name it, football, you know, where coaches desire those athletes that can be creative and innovative and know, you know, how to best make the optimal decision in the right moment, you know, in those moments of truth. But it seems to be kind of a muddy water term too, right? Because, you know, so many of these younger fundamental programs that they're calling themselves sports specific, in this case basketball programs, they become just drill factories. So you got, you know, the player waiting 45 seconds before the next guy in line, which is not really challenging decision making. Or you have you know, those players that are in a coaching program where the coach try to covers literally every possible scenario on the court, and then you're really developing these robot players that they can't think for themselves. You know, so, you know, what? How do you kind of attack or respond when you see, you know, those two scenarios?
Well, I think it's Bobby Knight said it, or maybe it came from Pete Newell, that the game is overcoached and undertaught. And I think that's kind of what you're getting at is, you know, and some of it is kind of a backlash. I know when I was younger, we used to play this one team in our Catholic schools league, and all the coaches in the stands, they're always good. They always had a lot of talent, and they always got criticized. They always criticized the coach for, oh, he just rolls the ball out, and, you know, the players win the games for him, you know. So I think coaches have this idea that you have to show how much you're coaching, you know, in order to be considered a good coach, whether that's, you know, standing up on the sideline yelling and screaming or making sure that your kids are in nice orderly lines, you know, at practice. That's one of the things that I talk about is, you know, that it's okay to have a little bit of chaos in practice. You know, I think coaches tend to want the black or white. And I think games like basketball or soccer are played in various shades of gray. So even though you can talk about, you know, an optimal solution for a situation or, you know, what you hope to happen, you know, whether you're putting in a play or whatever, it's not always going to work. So, you know, I'd like to come down and run a play where I get a wide open layup every single time down the court. You know, we'd probably be pretty good. But, you know, that's what the defense is trying to take away. So if that's our first option in our play, and it's taken away every time because the defense knows it's the first option, we have to be able to then move on from there and play a little bit and find a way, whether it's by passing, screening, et cetera, you know, to get a good shot. And I think a lot of the learning needs to take place by playing as opposed to simply doing drills. I think one of the misconceptions or one of the mistakes that's made a lot in coaching is the assumption that just because you practice something, you're going to improve at it, you know. So if I practice passing, for instance, and I do a, you know, two-man passing drill where we just pass the ball back and forth to each other, we might be improving our ability to pass the ball back and forth to each other. But in a game, the limiting factor has nothing to do with the physical skill of being able to throw a basketball 15 feet. The limiting factor is going to be whether I, you know, see my defensive player, whether I can account for the speed of my teammate that I'm passing the ball to, and I can read the direction that he's running to, that I can do the same for the defensive player guarding him, that I can see if there's a help defensive player that's getting into that passing lane, that I see that maybe while I'm focused on the guy that's using a screen on the left side, maybe the post player to my right is wide open, but I don't see him because I'm so focused on trying to get the player, you know, using a screen the ball. You know, and these are things that just doing a 5-on-0 drill or you know, a 2-on-0 passing drill, you're not learning those skills, because the skills is reading the defense, being able to anticipate the defense and react to the defense. And so to learn to be able to play in those situations, there has to be defense in the drill, whether it's a scrimmage situation or a small-sided game or, you know, just doing a passing drill 2-on-2 instead of 2-on-0, you know, or 3-on-3 or something like that, where, you know, you're being able to combine the perception with the action. You know, too often in drills, we try to teach the perception or the decision-making part separate from the physical part. And I think skills are best learned if you can combine those two things while you're teaching passing. You're also you're coupling the perception with the action.
Yeah. So how would you summarize in a few sentences, you know, what makes your approach then unique to maybe other systems out there of development?
I'd say I'm different because I focus on small-sided games and using competition in as many drills that I do as possible. So I try to get away with standing in line and get away from drills that, in my eyes, don't transfer well to the game. So going beyond my two sentences, there's Schmidt and Lee have shown that random and variable practice will transfer to a novel situation better than a block practice situation. And a lot of what you see in most practice situations is more of a block practice, where if I'm going to work on passing, I'm only, you know, I'm working on 20 chest passes in a row, and then I'm going to work on 20 bounce passes in a row, and then I'm going to work on 20 overhead passes in a row. And I mean, that's how I was taught when I was growing up. Whereas a random or variable, you know, you're going to incorporate different passes in the same drill and, you know, add defense or throw passes of different lengths, et cetera, et cetera. So the drill becomes more and more like the game, because the closer the drill is to a game, or the more representative the task, the better the transfer is going to be.
Sure. Now, I think, though, for clarity purposes, and Brian, because we have a lot of young coaches that, you know, listen to the Coach Your Best podcast, and I mean, you're not saying that block practice in and of itself is a bad type of practice, right? Is that what I hear you saying? That we want to make sure that we incorporate random and variable styles of practice, not just block practice. Is that correct?
Correct.
Right.
And, you know, everything is dependent on the players that you have, the ages, their ability, their skill level. You know, so every situation is going to be different. So there's no kind of one way, you know, to do everything. But in general, the less time you can spend in block practice and the more time you can spend in tasks that are more like the game, the better the transfer of those skills from the practice to the game should be.
Yeah, sure. You know, and I think in previous podcast series and episodes, I've had a number of really great conversations about, you know, how to design practices. My last one being with Nick Winkelman and Joe Baker, that was kind of the original conversation in his book, and in developing in sports science principles and practice design, and how really how to flow those through. So great ideas there. Now, you also talk about, you know, in your book, this whole idea of teaching games for understanding model. So why don't you unpack that for our listeners here just a little bit?
So teaching games for understanding is a model. Off the top of my head, it's Joy Butler, I think, is one of the first people that kind of started the or wrote the book on it. And it's kind of it's more of a physical education approach, I would say, to teaching skills through gameplay as opposed to, you know, through more block practice or technique type drills. So their basic kind of idea was that in PE, too many children get lost because you spend so much time trying to get them ready to play the game. But if you just give them a simple idea of kind of what the objective is or what the goal is, and then put them into a game, they'll be more successful and have more fun. And in a lot of ways, that's counterintuitive to the way that a lot of coaches think, because a lot of coaches think, well, you know, I can't play basketball if I don't know how to shoot properly, I don't know how to dribble properly, I don't know how to pass properly, you know, I don't know what a traveling violation is, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Whereas their argument is, you know, simplify the game if you can, but get them into a game situation as opposed to spending, you know, an entire PE class, you know, just working on the fundamental of shooting, and then nobody actually gets any physical activity, you know, or same with passing, you know. So it's kind of, it's along the same lines of, you know, the things that I was talking about previously, but it's kind of set up for a PE, more of a PE curriculum type of philosophy. There's another book called Play Practice by Alan Launder. From Australia, and he talks about a lot of the same principles and the same ideas as the teaching games for understanding. But when I replay practice, I read it a lot more, him talking about it as an actual practice standpoint for developing for a team as opposed to kind of a physical education setting. And then kind of building on both those ideas, the more current kind of philosophy or theory is the constraints-based approach, where you basically look at the task environment and the person, and as a coach, you kind of manipulate one or all of those three to create a drill or a game to work on the skill that you're trying to practice. So, for instance, in my practices, you know, let's say I'm trying to work on shooting kind of within a game situation. Rather than just doing standstill shooting drills, you know, I might play an advantage game, you know, let's say like 5-on-3 in the half court, but you can only shoot from outside the key, no layups, you know. So because there's an offensive advantage, you should always have an open shot, you know, if you can work the ball, you know, and then, but there's defense should be somewhere close to where they should be able to close out and contest the shot to some degree. So that's just kind of a quick idea. So I'm going to manipulate kind of the environment by taking two defensive players away so that I can work on shooting in more of a real game situation as opposed to just, you know, sending kids to different baskets and have them do a traditional shooting drill.
Yeah, it's a great example. Great example. Now, again, you know, for these younger coaches out there, Brian, what do you mean by basketball is an open skill sport?
So that's another motor learning topic. So a closed skill is something where it's self-paced. So in basketball, a free throw is really the only thing or only skill to be considered a closed skill because, you know, there's no defensive pressure. For the most part, I have as much time as I want to shoot the ball. So it's completely self-initiated. You know, I do my routine, I take my time, you know, there's nothing forcing me to do anything. But the rest of basketball is an open skill because it's not self-paced. There's, you know, something in the environment or something externally is going to affect what you do. You know, whether it's, you know, when I go to shoot, I shoot because nobody's near me, so I'm open, but I have to read that environment to know that I'm open. You know, or maybe I have to shot fake and go by a defensive player. So my shot fake is because there's a defensive player there. You know, if there wasn't a defensive player there, I wouldn't make a shot fake. You know, and so the other reason why it'd be an open skill is because of the kind of the complexity of the skills in basketball because of moving defensive players, the moving ball, you being on the move, all those kind of factors make it into an open skill. But the most important one is it's the game is not self-paced. It's externally paced, and what you do is in relation to and dependent upon the other players as well as the ball.
Yeah, like and you know, last question here as we wrap up episode one, Brian, again, just dialing into these younger coaches, you know, what do you mean by task complexity? Again, probably another motor learning phrase.
Definitely.
You know, but why is that really important for these younger coaches to understand?
Well, first, tax complexity is basically looking at if you're going to put a skill kind of on a continuum from, simple to complex. The things that you're going to look for is the variability between trials. So, free throw is less complex than a jump shot during the game because you're always shooting from the same defense or same spot, and there's never defense there. Whereas within the game, you're going to shoot from different spots. Defense is going to be a different distance away from you. You're going to dribble sometimes. You're going to catch sometimes. Other things that go into the complexity is object manipulation. So basketball has a ball in it. So skills that involve the ball are going to be more complex than skills, that don't involve a ball. Skills that use your feet are going to be more complex than skills that use your hands. Skills that use a stick as opposed to your hands are going to be more complex. So in that respect, lacrosse or hockey would be a more complex. So passing a lacrosse ball or a puck in hockey would be a more complex skill than passing a basketball for that reason. And then also movement. So things that are stationary are going to be less complex than things that are on the move. So like I said, in basketball, despite the way that everybody kind of considers it, free throws would be one of the least complex skills in basketball because there's no moving parts and the skill, there's no variability. Whereas something like a fast break is going to be, or facing a press is going to be a much more complex skill because of, the ball being involved, dribbling. It's never going to look the same. When you run a half-court offense, you can try as much as you want to make the play look exactly the same every time, but a fast break's not going to look the same. Defense, sometimes they're going to be ahead of you, sometimes they're going to be next to you, sometimes it's 2-on-1, 3-on-2, 4-on-3. So, it's so variable, and there's so many different moving parts that it makes the situation a lot more complex. So it's important to think of for a coach because one of the things that coaches try to do, especially with younger players, is to simplify. But when we simplify the task, we don't want to remove the task too much from the game. That's why, a lot of coaches that I watch, they spend a lot of time playing 5-on-0 offense, or doing 5-on-0 fast breaks or 3-on-0 fast breaks, things like that, thinking that because it's, a simple variation of the skill that they're going to do in the game, that it's going to help them develop that skill. But when you take the defense out, they're not learning how to perform in the environment that's causing the mistakes. So rather than simplifying that way, it's something like, I mentioned before with the 5-on-3 shooting game, or, I do a lot of advantage passing games, which soccer coaches, will do, I do them, a little bit more even than your typical soccer drill, but 5-on-3, 5-on-4, 6-on-4, those kind of things. Excuse me, with younger players, so that they can have a good deal of success, and it's not making the passing that much more difficult, but they have to be aware of the defense, and they have to be able to find who should I be passing the ball to, where's the right decision, and same thing, rather for me, rather than playing 5-on-0 to make the game simpler, is I'll play 2-on-2. Because that takes away a lot of the decisions that I could possibly make. Because now, as an offensive player, I'm either shooting or I'm passing, and I only have one person to pass to, and I only have two defensive players to account for, my defensive player and the defensive player guarding my teammates. So I don't have to worry so much about help defense. So it simplifies the skill. But it doesn't remove the skill from the game, and it still makes the skills that I'm trying to practice very much representative of what they're going to see in a game.
Yeah, I love it. I love it. Well, as we wrap up here, Brian, let me just throw out this last question for you, kind of put you on the spot. What's the single most important thing that a coach listening right now can do this week to help develop basketball intelligence? One thing, if you could just say, here's one global kind of broad general example that you would, suggest a coach could do this week, what would that be?
For most coaches, I'd probably say talk less. Play more, play more, talk less, and encourage mistakes.
I like it. I like it. Listen, Brian, thanks for your time. And hey, listen, you know, for the listeners now, in part two of this new podcast series, Play Better Basketball, Brian and I are going to kind of get into some more practical application on how you can even better and further develop basketball intelligence and athletic performance with your players. So, Brian, thanks for your time and look forward to having you back here soon.
All right. Thanks a lot. Appreciate it.